Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we'll be talking with Dr. Heidi Roth, Associate Professor and Sleep Specialist at UNC's Department of Neurology, about sleeping too much or too little, answers on your health, and a very common problem, one of sleep, and one that I think a lot of our listeners will be interested in hearing about.
Do you think as a doctor and a mother of two young children, Christy, that you sleep too much or too little? Or, yeah, just right, the little bear that's right. Just right.
Yeah, I would probably say too little.
Yeah.
I need more sleep than some.
And see, I get by on less sleep, but I do know that there's this huge variation. We know that a lot of people don't get enough sleep. So we're going to get to explore all these questions. But first, we also have some really interesting research that matters. Actually, one of those research is about sleep, but we're also going to be talking about older adults and falling.
We'll talk about people joining walking groups.
We're going to talk about tweeting and the things that you tweet. Is that related to health?
And about access for Medicaid patients and Obamacare.
Well, let's talk about this very first research that matters, which is about falls, which, as we know, if you take sleep medications as you get older, that you may have some increased risk of falling. But this was a study that's in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Internal Medicine, about actually an increase in the percent of people who are falling, not just associated with people getting older, but as a society, more people are falling at older ages too.
And this was published in the JAMA Internal Medicine edition and looking at really an increase in the number of reported falls for adults ages 65 and older.
From 28% of seniors reporting a fall in 1998 to 36% in 2010.
So hard to know, is that because of an increase in sleep medicines or pain medicines or other things that we're doing that can increase falls, or are people reporting them more because maybe they're perhaps more aware of falls and that being a problem as they get older?
Or are people, as they get older, doing more risky things that maybe presuppose them to fall?
Sure.
I myself know that as we've had ice in the community over the last few days to weeks, that I shouldn't be moving the ice with a shovel on a downhill with very slippery shoes.
I've discovered that
predisposes to falls.
Really?
Well, that's very interesting. I don't know if we can, what we do with this, other than say that fall risk isn't just limited to people over the age of 85. It's really at increasingly younger ages that there are risk of falls. And once you've had a fall, you really don't want to have them again, so we'd like to prevent them in the first place.
Mm-hmm. So think about your shoes and your surface and just making wise choices as you're getting around.
And ask your doctor about medications that you're taking that could contribute.
That's true. Let's talk about walking and walking groups. This is really fun. This was some research published in the British Journal of Sports Medicine suggesting that joining a walking group might have benefits to your health.
Yeah, this was research of 42 studies that involved 2,000 adults in 14 countries, and it looked at both the physical health and the mental health of people who then joined an outdoor walking group. And on the surface of it, literally the surface, walking, little pun intended, is that this would seem like a good thing, and indeed it was.
Yeah, of course it has benefits, but this showed that looking at these 42 studies, joining a walking group led to decreases in blood pressure, decreases in resting heart rate, body fat, weight, and total cholesterol, and had some improvements in physical functioning and the power of the lungs.
And we do know that physical activity can help out with mental health, and they found some of those same things in this study. And most importantly, almost 75% of those who were in the walking group continued exercising. And I guess the question would be, well, were there any negative side effects? And, well, there probably were, and they talked a little bit about some increased falls or in bad weather. So a walking group certainly isn't for everyone, but boy, this sounds like a really good thing. I can see myself writing on a prescription. Writing on a prescription.
Join a walking group.
How do I do that? I don't know.
There are lots of walking groups at different malls and through senior centers, and there are lots of resources in the community. So you should look into one in your community. Let's talk next about tweets and what they say about heart health.
Are you a tweeter?
No.
No? I wouldn't say I'm a high-volume tweeter. I'm a low-volume tweeter, which also makes it, when you don't tweet very much, like then you feel like
like
if
whatever
I write a tweet,
you say, it
has to be
really amazing.
Important.
That's why I don't do it.
But I have looked at sometimes tweets that others send out, and I notice like some people really tweet things that I'm like embarrassed to even repeat and probably couldn't repeat. I'd be violating FCC laws if I repeated some of the four-letter words that people tweet routinely. And it seems to me a lot of people are angry when they tweet. And the question is that have an effect potentially on health?
Yeah. So some University of Pennsylvania researchers studied about 140 million random tweets from 2009 and 2010 and kind of tried to see if there was a relationship of what people said and a correlation with heart disease mortality rates of from where those tweets came from.
So you can look down at some pretty small levels and at a county level or local levels, and they found that there were increased mortality rates associated with areas where these tweets had a lot of anger displayed. And conversely, there appeared to be decreased mortality rates when the tweets were kinder. And I assume those are probably six-letter words, kinder, yes.
Yes. Well, the single word predictor of heart disease was the word hate, H-A-T-E, hate, which is actually a word that's not allowed in my household. But
because you say, God, I hate this. And you're like, no, well, you dislike
like,
it.
Yeah, hate's it's such a strong it's,
word.
It really
right.
is.
I tell my kids it's a bad word, and they like,
is.
Dad. No,
I
it
know.
Is.
Yeah, exactly.
And now we have proof.
Exactly. Now we have proof. It'll lead to heart disease. But this is, this is a population level, and we would need further study to be able to really tie specifically your words with your risk of heart disease on a more individual level. But I mean, it does sort of go along with what we know. If you put a lot of stress and anger into your life and into your words, that may have an impact on, and it makes sense that it may have an impact on stress and your heart.
So we only want one four-letter word.
Love.
Or like. Let's talk about our very last research that matters, Christy. And this is something near and dear to both of us, which is the potential impact of changes in access to care, where people get more access like to Medicaid, which is sometimes very difficult to find providers who take Medicaid, with changes in reimbursement that happened under the Obamacare, and where these two things actually link to each other.
And what they found is that there's some evidence that one of the aims of Obamacare may have some impact, that increasing Medicaid reimbursements for primary care to make more generous payments from Medicare to doctors, that actually increases patient access to health care. So if Medicare actually pays doctors to take care of patients a little closer to what private insurances pay, then doctors may be more willing to see those patients, and somehow that's influencing access to care for patients with Medicare.
Yeah, actually, so this is in the New England Journal of Medicine.
Medicaid.
This is Medicaid, which but they're trying to make Medicaid, as you say, very similar to Medicare, because the reimbursement rates for Medicaid are sometimes much lower. And what they called here was the pay bump. And this pay bump seemed to actually have a significant increase that is linked. So this is actually, I think, good news. Primary care providers, very difficult job. And I'm sure this was not, this didn't increase the reimbursement up to a private pay patient, didn't even increase it in many states up to Medicare, but it approached that in some of the states.
It increased the Medicaid reimbursements closer to what Medicare pays.
That's right. And for a lot of doctors, that doesn't even cover the overhead. It's a good news, though. This is a success story. The question is, can this continue? And this is just one small piece, but it's good news.
It is good news. Okay, well, that will wrap up the Research That Matters portion of our show. We've had to talk a little bit about some improvements in access for Medicaid patients, some relationships between what your tweets say about your heart health,
about joining a walking group, and about as you're joining that walking group, let's pay attention to avoiding falls.
We are going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Heidi Roth, Associate Professor and Sleeping Specialist at UNC's Department of Neurology, about sleep too much or too little. Answers on your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Heidi Roth, Associate Professor and Sleeping Specialist at the University of North Carolina's Department of Neurology, about sleeping too much or too little. Answers on Your Health.
Tell us, Dr. Roth, first, thank you for being with us, and tell us about yourself and what sparked your interest in neurology and specifically in sleep.
All right. Actually, if we start with neurology, I was most interested in brain and brain function and memory and cognition and thinking. And I think then the transition to sleep happened somewhat naturally, just because when you're thinking about brain function and cognition and memory, you have to think about all the different factors that play into affecting brain function. And one of them you think about is sleep. Another is mood. Another might be general medical health. But sleep is one of those big factors that's potentially treatable that can really help people who might have problems with memory and attention. And that's probably where my interest in sleep comes from.
Can you give me an example of what you're talking about when you say someone who maybe has a problem with memory and attention, and then we talk about sleep? Give us an example of something you might be talking about.
Well, I guess it started, my practice really started with taking care of people who had early dementia. Mm-hmm. And in that population, just to point out, a lot of people are doing very well. And they function quite well, but they're looking for answers about how to improve their memory. And sometimes you see people whose sleep is so disrupted that it causes that ability to function, get around during the day, make appointments, remember things at the grocery store. The types of things that happen when people are having memory problems early on.
So the sleep disruption is a result of the Alzheimer's, or is it something that they had previously that's now worse because of the Alzheimer's?
Well, that's an interesting question, but I would say because there are bidirectional relationships, but one thing we do know is that if somebody has some cognitive impairment from a disease, then the sleep could make it worse.
So if they're already having trouble with memory and then they're not sleeping,
then
it's even worse.
And then sleeping, that can make that worse. And medications can make that worse. That's another thing you can really focus in on to try to improve people if they're taking the wrong medications that make their memory worse too.
Like what sort of things would be common perhaps in someone who's elderly?
There's so many medications that cause problems with memory, but maybe one common one, and I would include medications over the counter, like Benadryl, Tylenol PM, Advil PM, medications like amitriptyline, dizipramine, nortriptyline that have the anticholinergic side effects.
And ironically, something like amitriptyline, or kind of brand name Elavil, is given for sleep by a lot of doctors, right?
Right. Which,
or at least, is one of the old-fashioned sorts
of ways. Right, it is, yes. And it might be acceptable in someone who really doesn't have as many memory problems. It's really not a favored medication, though, for sleep specialists. And there are other indications for that medication that might make you choose that medication if somebody has pain or headaches or certain kinds of anxiety, where you might go with that medication. But if you're thinking about memory, that would be a poor choice just because of that particular medication's potential adverse effects on memory. Actually, speaking of amitriptyline, there are other sleep-related problems you can have that are worsened by amitriptyline. So if someone has restless leg syndrome, they can have paradoxically worse sleep when treated with amitriptyline. So I guess it's important to think of the person's individual health problems and what's affecting their sleep, what's affecting their memory, what other medical problems they have. And if the main focus is on helping their memory and improving their sleep, in some cases, then Elevil would be a poor choice.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about this interesting relationship between sleep and memory, and then medicines that might be given for sleep that then can perhaps make them both worse. Let's back up just a second and talk about normal sleep patterns. How, we say too much or too little. What's normal?
And is anyone just right?
Yeah, exactly. Or just right. But what is normal? And then what are the most common sleep disorders?
Can I back up just a minute before I answer that question? Because you summarized our conversation before, and I think it sort of stimulates a particular issue. And that is that we start medication sometimes for people with memory problems, including the cholinesterase inhibitor agents like Aricept, which is probably the most well-known medication to help people's memory. But it's interesting to know that Aricept in about 20% of people causes insomnia.
Hmm.
And then so some of those patients then might get started on a medication to help their sleep, which would then counteract any of the benefits from Aricept. So again, it's important to practice individualized medicine. If someone had no problems with sleep, you might use that medication, but I rarely use it, even though it's considered more common.
Mm-hmm.
So just to kind of point out how it's important to think of all these factors when you're choosing medications for one reason. You asked about what's normal, and I think that's something that is actually, there isn't really one answer to that. I think everybody's different. I think that's one of the things you really come to learn in the practice of sleep medicine, but also in this practice of cognition and treating people with memory and dementia. Everyone is different, and in terms of sleep need, everyone is different. You'll see guidelines out there. Everyone needs 8 hours of sleep. Certain age groups need certain amounts of sleep, but one size doesn't fit all. There are people who have insufficient sleep, and certainly if you interview someone and they say, I really feel better when I get X and X amount of sleep, then they probably should get X and X amount of sleep.
So how do you define a sleep disorder, or what are the most common disorders you see as defined by that individual and their symptoms?
So how do you define a sleep disorder? Basically, the first thing I think that's important is to listen to what the patient is saying, or the person is having a problem with, what their complaint is, and then you try to figure out what's causing that problem. So somebody might come in and they might say, I don't have any problems with sleep, but I'm sleepy all day. Well, their sleep at night they perceive as normal, whereas someone else might say, I just can't fall asleep, but once I fall asleep, I'm fine and I sleep well. Someone else might say, I fall asleep fine, but then I wake up a lot during the night. So finding out what specifically the problem is that the person is experiencing is really important. And then depending on the report of that symptom, then you can think about different things that could be causing it. But some common, maybe it's helpful to know that, of course, sleep problems are common.
We see it. Yes. They're coming to us before they even come to you. They come to us, and we hear all the time. Oh, by the way, and it's usually at the end of the visit, after a 30-minute visit, you say, by the way, I'm having a hard time sleeping. And the conversation is usually, can you write a pill?
Yeah.
And that's the hard part, because it implodes. You have to have such a long conversation.
Right. So, I was reading recently about 50% of people complain of poor sleep and restless sleep. So that's a large number of people. Maybe about 10 to 15% of people have chronic insomnia. But other sleep disorders that are very common are sleep apnea, restless leg syndrome, circadian rhythm disorders, including delayed sleep phase, and insufficient sleep, just not getting enough sleep.
Well, we're going to talk about a lot of these in just a second, and we're going to need to take a short break. But when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Heidi Roth, Associate Professor and Sleep Specialist at University of North Carolina's Department of Neurology, about sleeping too much or too little, or lots of other questions. All this and much more answers on your health. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Heidi Roth, Associate Professor and Sleeping Specialist at UNC's Department of Neurology, about sleep too much or too little, answers on your health. And Dr. Roth, you were talking a little bit about how common it is to have sleeping problems and just the complex relationship between memory and sleep and mood and other health issues, restless leg and sleep apnea and all kinds of things that can be related to someone's sleep. And yet, as primary care doctors, we have a lot of times patients just sort of tag on, oh, and I need a sleeping pill, and people want that sleeping pill to help them sleep. How do you recommend that patients and their physicians approach a sleeping problem and thinking about those things and perhaps going to other measures before sleeping pills?
Yes, I think that's a great question. And I think the first thing to realize is that sleep is a medical problem. It has medical consequences if someone's not sleeping well. And people who are not sleeping well, it may be the manifestation of a problem that needs to be addressed that will have consequences for someone's health. So it needs to be prioritized and not just tacked on at the end.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that it takes some time to figure out what a sleep problem is related to. And I think in the current environment where physicians have less time to spend with their patients, it sort of behooves someone to actually take the time, maybe another appointment, to discuss only that problem and try to get to the bottom of it.
Can you think of an example of something that was not obvious when it first came to you that it took a little time that you uncovered? Give us an example of what you're talking about, maybe.
For example, I saw a woman a couple of weeks ago who has always had trouble with sleep maintenance. So she tends to wake up a lot during the night. But for her, she isn't particularly tired during the day. So she went about her business fine. One of her brothers was diagnosed with sleep apnea, but he was chronically ill, and she thought, well, that's because he's chronically ill. But then a second brother was diagnosed with sleep apnea, and she thought, well, maybe I should get checked out for that. This is a woman maybe in her mid to late 50s, maybe early 60s. And she came in just with that complaint of not being able to sleep well at night. Because of the constellation of symptoms, we suspected that it might not be a pure insomnia. And we obtained a sleep study. And in this case, she had severe sleep apnea. Huh. And one thing that people don't recognize is that people with sleep apnea, which is disruption of breathing at night that can lead to oxygen desaturations and poor sleep, is that people may not be sleepy during the day. And sleep apnea has consequences for heart disease risk, for stroke risk, for diabetes, for hypertension, and people may not be realizing that they have it. So the wrong thing to do would be to put this person on a medication just to treat the problem with sleeping continuity and then not realizing that it could have been, in fact, a case of someone with sleep apnea.
Because what she needs is a machine at night to help her.
Right. And there are different options for treatment with sleep apnea. It doesn't have to be a machine. And I certainly let people know that because I think people get wary of that being such a big deal. But depending on the sleep apnea, there are other interventions that can be effective, including dental appliance or even just side therapy.
But a medication wouldn't do
no,
the trick.
No, it would mask the problem, probably. And medications all have side effects.
So
the other thing,
let
me just tell you about her, though, because when she did come back, she was so grateful because she had slept better than she'd ever slept. Now, she just didn't bring it up because she didn't think it was that important. But she did beautifully and adapted beautifully to this and noticed that she had more energy during the day, though it hadn't been something that she had really thought to bring up because you don't have a sort of you don't have anything to compare it to if mm-hmm. you've had it chronically. So sometimes people don't realize the extent to which it's impacting their daytime.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about, we hear about sleep hygiene, because there's a lot of mm-hmm. large population that can't fall asleep, don't stay asleep. And we assume, at least as primary care doctors, that a lot of this is due to some either environmental mm-hmm. or behavioral factors that we're trying to get to. Help us understand how much of the sleep problems of people not being able to fall asleep or stay asleep are due to abnormal behaviors that we do or not dealing with some things that we can deal with without medication.
I think that's interesting you bring up sleep hygiene. You say things that we can deal with without doing medication. I would just point out that sleep hygiene in people with insomnia is not effective. So if you try to practice sleep hygiene and tell people about sleep hygiene, it will not treat that patient's insomnia. And there's been lots of studies that show, in contrast, if you do well-designed therapy for insomnia that's behavioral but not medication, it's very effective.
So what types of things do you recommend?
So certainly you want to take care of those things that are sleep disruptors that you can, like substances like caffeine. Mm-hmm. And people with insomnia, caffeine needs to be eliminated completely, mm-hmm. even in the morning, since it can have effects for over 24 hours. So certainly that's a big, big problem. Substances like alcohol, sometimes people feel like it helps them fall asleep, but in fact it causes mm-hmm. increased sleep problems in the latter half of the night and increased sleepiness the next day. As you adapt to the use of alcohol, it doesn't have the benefits of helping you fall asleep. So that's another substance that you have to work on mm-hmm. changing. Opiate medications, which are pain medications that affect the opiate receptor, can also be problematic for sleep, especially if someone has sleep disordered breathing problems. So those are things we'd like to try to stay away from. What happens with people who have problems with sleep? It's sort of interesting that people start to think they should go to bed a little bit earlier. This is one of the problematic behaviors. So actually, what you need to do if somebody has insomnia, not sleep apnea, you want to look for in sleep apnea and restless leg syndrome, is, and somewhat counterintuitively, you want to restrict the sleep period to a shorter sleep period. So people with chronic insomnia, if you say, no, do not go to bed before midnight, and yes, you have to get up before 6, and you put them on that regimen for a couple of weeks, that helps their natural biological rhythms to get more in sync. And that sleep restriction component of therapy for insomnia is extremely effective, if not more effective than medications, and certainly has no side effects unless you have a bipolar disorder or some other things that could be exacerbated by sleep deprivation. But we see, and I can think of many of these patients who've had chronic insomnia that have been on many medications over the years without really getting benefit. And it's only when you put this type of sleep restriction practice in place that they get 6 hours a night, and they are eternally grateful. So this is what we call cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. And as I discussed with some of the residents of the hospital on multiple occasions recently, it's something that can be done by physicians who are informed. So I sort of feel like it's something that needs to be done a little bit more, and that sleep hygiene itself is not the answer, yet medications are not the answer. Mm-hmm. So it's not just one or the other of those two things.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about medication. So a lot mm-hmm. of patients are either self-medicating with Benadryl, Tylenol PM, the different mm-hmm. Unisom, taking melatonin regularly, and those kinds of things. And then you've got the doctor prescriptions and maybe over-prescribing of Ambien and some of these other medications that can have side effects. Give us some ideas of what things patients should look out for. I mean, is taking a Benadryl every now and then okay? Mm-hmm. What are the sort of things that people should know mm-hmm. that perhaps they don't?
I'm sort of recalling a patient I saw, an older man who's very healthy and didn't take any medications. In fact, he only took vitamins and only ate juices from, you know, natural mm-hmm. juicing that he actually performed himself. So very healthy oriented. And he came in with problems with sleep that he developed over the last couple of years. And he was only taking Benadryl to help him with that. As it turned out, after taking a detailed sleep history, he did have some restlessness feelings. And Benadryl is actually one of the worst medications for people who have restlessness. Mm-hmm. It's actually the test that we use to challenge people with restless leg syndrome. So that if somebody has that feeling of discomfort at night in their legs or body in some way and feels like they have to move around a little bit, and that sometimes extends into sleep with periodic limb movements that actually cause sleep disruption, the Benadryl actually can be actually causing the sleep to be worse. Mm-hmm. So those medications aren't without problems, even for people who are having sleep difficulties with regard to that actual goal you have for improving sleep.
Mm-hmm.
The other problem with Benadryl is it has this anticholinergic side effect, and acetylcholine is important for memory and focus and concentration. And so these medications, they're over the counter, but the next day if people take these things, they can affect their memory and function. Mm-hmm. And I think people are very concerned about memory and function as part of the reason they're concerned about their sleep.
Right.
So that would be another reason not to do that. And if you think about it, if there was a way to treat this without using medication, wouldn't that be preferable?
Mm-hmm.
What about the medications like the Zolpidem or Ambien or those types of medicines? Because those, I imagine, in terms of the top prescribing drugs mm-hmm. in society, those of, in the United States, they've got to be one of the top 10.
Yeah. So medications for sleep, you know, there have been advances in those medications. They're better than the ones that came before, like Dalmane or other medications that were less developed sleep medications. But any hypnotic has side effects. So if there are alternatives where you don't have to use the medications at all, it's certainly certainly something that should be considered. And I think probably the reason that people get more medications probably than they need is because people don't feel comfortable with treatment of insomnia or sleep disorders on their own enough. It takes some time in the interview process, and that's why I'd sort of recommend for people to take it seriously and take a whole clinic visit to really discuss those sleep problems, get to the bottom of it. You don't want to be prescribing those medications that have adverse events just because somebody has sleep apnea.
Well, and a lot of people have been on these medicines for quite some time, and, mm-hmm. you know, they do not want you to take their Ambien away or their Zolpidem. How do you approach or tell us what you know about either being addicted to, mm-hmm. quote-unquote, these medicines and being able to come off?
Yes, I don't have a problem with this when I explain to people, and it's something that I think a physician could also become more comfortable with, is figuring out what really is the sleep problem. And if you figure out what really is the sleep problem, you can address it in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And as you're addressing that sleep problem, you can very slowly go down on those medications. So say somebody is on 10 milligrams of Ambien, which, by the way, is above the recommended
sure.
dose for older people or women. I don't feel that I have to stop it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I might go from 10 to 7.5 and alternate mm-hmm. that for weeks so that the person doesn't really feel mm-hmm. the change too much. You know, if we can get off of something that somebody's been on for 5 years over the course of 4 months, that's fine. It doesn't have to be right away.
Right.
While at the same time addressing some of the other factors that may actually be causing the sleep problem. Most people really want to be off those medications. If you give them the hope that you're actually addressing somebody.
Right, that you're not just cutting them off
right,
and saying good luck.
Giving them some other type of support that
sure.
may be successful. They're very
mm-hmm.
excited about that.
Mm-hmm.
We've been talking with Dr. Heidi Roth, Associate Professor and Sleeping Specialist at the University of North Carolina's Department of Neurology. And we're going to have to wrap up the conversation, but mm-hmm. Is there a website or some place that you recommend that people who really want more information to know, perhaps if they do have a sleep disorder that could be improved, what do you recommend for as a starting place for more information?
Yeah, you know, I don't have anything off the top of my head with regard to that. There is the American Academy of Sleep Medicine,
mm-hmm.
and they have a lot of information there, and there may be something at that website. They're sort of they coordinate kind of the whole professional organization of sleep medicine, and I think their information would be well vetted, so I might recommend that, but I'm
right.
not... you know, personally familiar with the
but an organization that has some legitimacy,
credible information.
Yes. Incredible yeah. information, and isn't trying to necessarily sell you one group of goods.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Well, we want to thank you so much for being with us and talking about sleep disorders. This is a really important issue for our listeners, and we appreciate your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
And if you have a question that you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask a guest executive producer, Jenica Siddle, a medical student who's with us today, to read us our very first house call question.
I am a 34-year-old and sit at the computer all day. Almost daily, my hands will seem to freeze, followed by a sharp pain that radiates through my hands. This lasts under 5 seconds and goes away. I just recently noticed this has begun to happen at home as well. Could I be experiencing early signs of arthritis?
Well, we sure hope not.
Yeah, 34, that would be...
Unusual.
Unusual, that's
a
good word.
But it can happen.
It can happen. Some people have trouble with their fingers feeling cold related to something called Raynaud's syndrome, or sometimes people have pains related to overuse if you're typing a lot from something like carpal tunnel, if the nerves are sort of getting compressed on the ways to your hands.
Yeah, I just kept thinking, I closed my eyes for a second and I was trying to visualize our listener's question here, and mm-hmm. I saw them typing really, really fast over and over and over and over and over uh-huh. and over, and I thought, oh my goodness gracious, those cramp in the fingers and the carpal tunnel and the compression of the nerve, I could just almost feel it yep. happening.
Yep, and there are treatments for that can be helpful. I think this is the kind of thing that you can try to rest your hands a little bit if possible. It sounds like you might have to use them a lot at work, but sometimes rest or those wrist braces on your wrist can be helpful.
Those wrist splints that you can get at almost any
drugstore,
and we lots of times say wear them at night to start with so that mm-hmm. you keep your hands and wrists kind of neutral, that you're not bending them in some funny direction. Like sometimes I notice when I'm about to fall asleep that my hand's kind of tucked underneath my wrist behind my elbow. Like, how did it get there?
You can also pay attention to how you're sitting and your posture at work when you're typing. And there are adjustments that can be made in your chair or in your workspace that sometimes that can make a difference.
Good advice. Let's go to our very next house call. Jenica?
I need some advice. My daughter is on day 3 of a bad stomach bug. She had a high fever the first 2 days, so I thought when that went away, she was on the mend. But she continues to reject food. And if she takes anything, she feels awful and ends up vomiting or having diarrhea. Do you have any ideas of how I can help her?
Well, I'm going to initially look to you, Christy, because this could be right up your alley. I've actually had most of my children past the 3-year-old, but you know what? I had a lot of this at that age.
Oh, yeah. And it's so hard because when they feel so bad and you want to make it better, on day 3, you know, it sounds like, you know, it's lasting a little bit long to not be taking anything. But so I would say on day 3, if she's still not taking anything and can't, is not drinking and eating, you need to take her in and get her checked out. That being said, I usually, if kids look well hydrated, the most important thing is getting those fluids into them, just a little bit, little sips. Of a popsicle or little sips every few minutes to keep the fluids going. And if they don't eat for a few days, that's okay.
Yeah, we relied sometimes on Pedialyte.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed that you could get it over these electrolyte solutions
yep.
that were really kind of neutral to the stomach. And
yep.
the kids seemed to tolerate them. And sometimes we only needed to buy a few hours, it seemed.
Yeah, exactly.
And sometimes that's what you need. It just needs to buy a little bit of time. Mm-hmm. What do you think about sometimes patients will ask me sometimes, can you give my child a medication to, you know, here? What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, there are medications that you can give that will help reduce vomiting, and then give them in the ER to kids and PCDs and stuff. I think most of these GI bugs and viruses that go around don't need medications that. And there can be side effects and other problems
so
with that.
So you'd want to see the child first,
too. Oh, yeah. I would just call that in. But the biggest thing is just keeping those fluids in and giving them TLC. And if they're not taking any, to get them checked out.
Love the TLC.
Mm-hmm.
Jenica, what's our very next house call?
My doctor told me I have subclinical hyperthyroidism. What is that? And should I be worried?
Well, you probably are going to be worried.
Yeah,
we've already worried you with that name.
It just sounds bad. Subclinical hyperthyroidism. It's a lot of big words that sound scary. I would be scared if someone said that, I think.
Yeah, and, you know, thyroid disease, you know, isn't something that anyone wants to have. But this happens really pretty frequently where we check someone. We may be worried about hypothyroidism and maybe they're having a sleep problem or something else. And we do a test and it comes out as a little hyperthyroid, but really not enough to really cause clinical symptoms. So we sometimes call it subclinical hyperthyroidism. it means something, but it means not as much. I mean,
right. I mean, it means that your thyroid tests were a little bit off in a way that they looked like your thyroid might be a little bit overactive. And that probably your doctor is going to want to repeat those tests and follow that over time. But if you're not having any symptoms related to it and they're just very mildly overactive, then usually the doctor wants to evaluate that further, but it's not some big, terrible, nasty diagnosis.
But we wouldn't say to ignore it because sometimes this subclinical hyperthyroidism still could be affecting things like your heart and your bones. So we'd encourage you to see your doctor.
And it could progress also to be more significant.
That's right. And maybe even have to see a specialist if you want to get some more information. So thank you for that question. Jenica, what's our very last house call?
I'm a 45-year-old woman who has experienced pain in my pelvis for the last 2 weeks. I went to an urgent care about a week ago, but I don't have a primary care provider. I was instructed to take Tylenol as needed, and they couldn't find anything wrong. What could this be?
Well, we could have a whole show on pelvic pain.
We
should, because it's such an important issue. And so thank you, first off, for this question.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that you went to an urgent care, it's hard to know what tests they did or what. I mean, hopefully they did some sort of examination and some tests and a history to find out what it could be. And I'm sorry that you left without any answers. But pelvic pain could come from something related to your menstrual cycle, could come from something called endometriosis. It could come from all kinds of different, come from your muscles, could come from your colon, could come from, I mean, you can have pelvic pain if you've had surgeries in the past, that sometimes you get inflammation or scarring that will cause pelvic pain.
You can have something going on with your bladder and an infection.
Yep.
And the thing everyone's worried about, of course, is this is cancer. So let's just get that word out there, and we'll talk about that, and then we'll kind of figure out some strategies, because it almost usually is not going to be that. But you're going to need to have a primary care doctor, so we're going to encourage you to find one. If you need some help, let us know.
Yeah. Thank you for good questions today on house calls and for joining us today on Your Health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you, and we want you to share your questions and stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, get our health app.
And we'd like to thank the University of North Carolina Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our guest today, Dr. Heidi Roth, and our guest executive producer, Jenica Siddle. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.